I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. The war in Ukraine is grinding on, and the humanitarian crisis grows more severe. While Russian forces have destroyed neighborhoods and targeted the civilian population, it has not been able to capture key cities, at least not yet. Now there's concern that a frustrated Vladimir Putin could resort to even more lethal weapons. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said this week the prospect of nuclear war is now back within the realm of possibility. That's a quote. After Russia's attack on Ukraine, Putin put his nuclear weapons on alert in response to what he called aggressive statements from the West. Early on in the war, his troops attacked a nuclear power plant in Ukraine, risking a catastrophe. Putin has made provocative statements in the past about his nuclear arsenal, the largest in the world. The U.S. has the second largest. We asked Joe Cirincione to join us. He's distinguished non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute and a national security analyst. He's written a number of books, including Nuclear Nightmares and Bomb Scare. He served on the International Security Advisory Board for Secretaries of State Hillary Clinton and John Kerry. And Joe Cirincione, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what is the UN Secretary General Guterres, what is he saying to us by saying the prospect of nuclear war is now back within the realm of possibility?
He is stating the obvious fact. We don't want to alarm anyone unduly, but we have to recognize the real risks that we have here. We are closer to war between the two largest nuclear-armed states than we've been since the early 1980s. I think the risk of a nuclear conflict is small, it's not likely, but it's not zero either, and that should worry us.
Is it, I mean, you know, we're not there yet, thank goodness, and we don't want to alarm people, but we want to be able to inform people. Is your concern that an actual nuclear war could be declared, or a tactical nuclear weapon be used by design, or some kind of accident would lead to the use of some kind of nuclear weapon?
Right, the latter two. No one is concerned about a bolt out of the blue nuclear attack, the kind of thing that worried us in the 1980s or during the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s. More, this is a nuclear scenario that would develop out of the conflict. You know, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, the U.S. and Russia, have never been in sustained direct combat before. There were a few skirmishes during the Korean War. There was an incident in Syria a few years ago, but nothing sustained. And the reason for that is that both sides have nuclear weapons. And the fear is that any combat between the two could escalate into an all-out nuclear war. This fear subsided after the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the large decreases in nuclear weapons that followed under the leadership of President Reagan, then George H.W. Bush, and then even George W. Bush and Clinton Obama all contributed to that decline. But that number of weapons has stopped. The decrease has stopped. And what's worrying is that both the United States and Russia have, over the last 10 to 15 years, actually increased the role of nuclear weapons in their war plans. For example, in the United States, nuclear weapons are integrated into the planning of the combatant commanders. So that, and Russia is the same way. They integrate nuclear weapons into conventional war plans. Since Putin has been in charge of the Russian Federation, all the major exercises we've seen of Russian forces include testing of nuclear weapon capable systems, not actual explosions, but nuclear-capable systems, including in the exercises he did right before Ukraine. So the fear is that if Putin feels he is losing the war in Ukraine, something very few of us thought possible a few weeks ago, but now is a real possibility, he could escalate. In order not to lose, he could raise the stakes, and that could include using nuclear weapons.
I've seen the phrase escalate to de-escalate. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. Where we have a phrase called integrated deterrence, where we would seamlessly transition from one level of battle, conventional weapons, to cyber, to nuclear, they have something called escalate to de-escalate, or in some translations, escalate to terminate, meaning that if they are losing a battle with the West, and it's specifically against the West, against a nuclear state, United States, or a NATO alliance, that they would use a nuclear weapon in some way, and there's various possibilities, to signal the seriousness of the situation. They consider this an existential threat, and they would hope that the United States or NATO then backs off and sues for peace.
What kind of nuclear arsenal does Russia have? They have the largest. We're second, not by much. But what do they have?
Right. They have about 6,000 nuclear weapons. We have about 5,500, roughly. And of those, each side has about 2,000 ready to use. So operationally deployed, configured for launch within minutes of notice. Each has 2,000. And these are very large nuclear weapons. These are not the Hiroshima, Nagasaki atomic bombs. These are thermonuclear bombs, hydrogen bombs. Each, on average, about 10 to 20 times the size of the Hiroshima blast. They come in a variety of delivery vehicles, what they call the mechanism by which you drop the weapons, so ICBMs, bombers, submarines, but also shorter range weapons, also airdrop munitions. And that's the kind of thing we'd probably be looking at in a Ukraine conflict, something dropped by an airplane on a target. But it doesn't necessarily have, their doctrine doesn't necessarily mean that they would use what's called a battlefield nuke. They could use a missile to span the oceans to hit a U.S. target, to hit a NATO target. The unclarity about their dark doctrine is one of the things that worries us the most. We just don't know what they're likely to do.
And what kind of damage? I mean, are we talking about then what's called a tactical nuclear weapon? Is that what we're, something that, as you said, is kind of ready to use if necessary?
Well, the damage could cover a range. So tactical really means the range of the delivery mechanism. Is it intended to go intercontinental or for the theater, for the battlefield? The yield of the weapon can also vary. So some of our tactical weapons are the same size as the weapons we put on our missiles or carry in our long-range bombers, about 10 times the size of Hiroshima or 150 kilotons. But they also can be scaled down. And this is another troubling development. Over the last 10 to 15 years, both Russia and the United States have tried to develop more usable nuclear weapons. The theory was that the weapons are too big, and each country was being what they call self-deterred, not using these because they were so enormous. One of these bombs, 150 kilotons, would completely destroy a medium-sized city. You know, all of downtown Washington, for example, would be crushed or burned under such a blast. But when you can bring them down to Hiroshima size, even below a tenth of the bomb, so maybe 1 kiloton, 2 kilotons, that's 2,000 tons of conventional weapons. Wow. Still much bigger than any conventional blast anyone has ever seen. The largest bomb in our arsenal, conventional, for example, is 11 tons, the so-called mother of all bombs. That's 11 tons. And we're talking about 1,000 tons at a minimum, and you would devastate dozens of square blocks of a downtown area, for example, wipe out a port, certainly wipe out an airfield. It would be an enormous destructive strike.
So we've gone from using or having nuclear weapons as a form of deterrence, something that would never be used because you would. So what is that, mutually assured destruction, to something that's now called a usable nuclear weapon?
Right. And, you know, the theory is well-intended. For example, Colin Kahl, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Biden administration, just in December gave a speech praising integrated deterrence. And what they mean by that is they didn't want to rely on nuclear weapons. They wanted to incorporate all the other ways we can deter countries, including economic sanctions, diplomacy, diplomatic isolation, etc. But in the process, what's basically happened is those who build and deploy the nuclear weapons, you know, actually enlarged the role in U.S. deterrence policy. They claim that nuclear weapons were the bedrock of everything else, that having nuclear weapons would allow us to act to deter other countries' aggression and coercion. And what we're seeing in Ukraine is the fallacy of that view, that these things don't help us deter Putin. Putin is using them as a nuclear shield to protect his aggression. You know, if it wasn't for nuclear weapons, the U.S. and NATO would be intervening right now in the Ukrainian war. We would be devastating those tank columns. We would be rescuing those Ukrainian people. But we can't, because Putin has nuclear weapons and he makes credible threats to use them if we should engage in direct combat.
I mean, this is obviously the worst case scenario, that if he were to actually use a nuclear weapon, what should be the response of the United States, of NATO? I think there are 9 countries in the world that have nuclear weapons. We obviously have the second largest. What would we do under those circumstances?
Well, we have actually exercised this dilemma in war games. And I know of one war game where exercised at the lower levels, that is the deputies, the assistant, deputy assistant secretaries, etc. When the adversary used a nuclear weapon, they refused to respond in kind. And they argued that we had sufficient conventional forces to respond, which is true. But they were overruled by their superiors, who felt in the war game. And this is the common response in the war games. The feeling becomes among the leadership of the military and the political leadership that you have to respond in kind, as they say. We cannot be deterred by that nuclear strike, so they will respond with their own measured, what they call a limited nuclear strike. And in the theory, and you can read this in our nuclear postures reviews, this is open discussion of how we conceive of these things, that we would control the escalation. We would control it to be a limited nuclear war. Unfortunately, when you test that theory in war games, it's never controlled. It escalates steadily into global thermonuclear war.
Can we say then that Putin is using his nuclear weapons as a kind of blackmail against the West?
Absolutely. In fact, that is the word to use, because when I said he's using it as a nuclear shield, it implies a sort of a good thing about that, that it has some power to protect. But blackmail is more accurate. It is a coercive instrument. There are things we can do now to discourage this current crisis that could discourage it. President Biden has done some of them. For example, he hasn't responded to Putin's nuclear threats. Putin has made several direct nuclear threats, warning of consequences unlike anything we've encountered in history, ominous consequences should we intervene. Biden has been very cool about this, not responded, not even referenced them, just let it go. And that's the right move. You do not want to rhetorically escalate. He also hasn't responded to Putin's claim that he raised the alert status of his nuclear forces. We're not sure what exactly that means, but we think it means that he is more easily able to execute a launch order. And President Biden hasn't done anything like that. We're not raising our alert level. So again, this is not like the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, it's many steps away from that yet. But there are more things that Biden could do.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this short break. And again, talking with Joe Cirincione today on Radio Times. He's distinguished non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute, a national security analyst. And we are talking about nuclear weapons. We're talking about Russia having the most nuclear weapons in the world. The U.S. is not far behind. Do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Joe Cirincione about what we need to know about Russia and its nuclear arsenal, also about Putin's bellicose language. And a bit later on in the show, we'll be talking about the role of information and disinformation in the Ukraine war. And again, and as always on Radio Times, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Joe, you said that President Biden, there is more that he can do to, I guess, deter and contain the possible threat of some kind of use of nuclear weapons. What else?
Right. The first is what we can do right now, and that is something that's been recommended by two of my colleagues and friends, John Wolfstall, in an article last week in Barron's. And just this morning, my friend Tom Kalina has an excellent op-ed online on the New York Times. And both of them say what I believe is also true. Biden and NATO leadership should declare right now that the U.S. and NATO have no intention of using a nuclear weapon first. That whatever our doctrine says, we are not going to start a nuclear war and encourage Putin to do the same. That will have a rhetorical effect, a diplomatic effect, but it could also lay the groundwork for developing an international norm against the first use of these weapons and therefore preventing a nuclear war scare like this happening in the first place. The second is that after this conflict is over, if and when we get through this, we got to change our attitude about nuclear weapons. We have to understand that the old ways of thinking about these, that these were our greatest security, that these were our most powerful weapons, is really outdated. These are our greatest threat. This is what's stopping us from confronting Putin in this aggression and would stop us from confronting other countries. And we have to pick up the mantle that was developed in the beginning of this century by those who said after the Cold War that there was no reason to have these weapons anymore and we should move aggressively to reduce and get rid of them. We were warned that if we didn't seize the momentum, didn't seize the moment at that time, that we would face, as Sam Nunn and Bill Perry and Henry Kissinger and George Shultz said, that we would confront a world that was more psychologically disorienting, that was more terrifying, that was more economically dislocating than even during the Cold War. Well, we're in that world now. We didn't seize the opportunity to get rid of these weapons when we had it. We better get back on that path once this conflict is over.
Early on in the war in Ukraine, we saw, I believe it was, you know, Russians attacking a nuclear power plant. They apparently took some of the workers there hostage. And, you know, we know about Chernobyl. We know about Three Mile Island. I found that very worrying. How about for you, Joe?
Well, that is the other nuclear risk that's present in Ukraine. In fact, we've never experienced this before, this confluence of so many nuclear threats in one place at one time. So in addition to the risk of intentional use, we have the risk of accidental use or confusion in the combat, but we also have the risk from nuclear power plants. No country has ever attacked a nuclear power plant. No country has ever seized one. And the risks are manifold. So both at the Chernobyl site, which is closed down but is a nuclear waste site, And at the nuclear power plant, Zaporizhia, we face the possibility that there could be an accident from the staff, which have been now going on 2 weeks without relief, cut off from the outside world, or from the loss of electricity, which has happened at both places, that could shut down the cooling systems that keep the fuel rods cool and prevent them from melting down, or other malfunctions, cracks in the containment vessels from attacks. And remember, there's three other nuclear power facilities with multiple reactors in Ukraine. And if this war goes on, you can expect Russia to attack those as well.
Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons or arsenal. I'm not sure exactly what the word is. What did they get in return for that?
They got security guarantees, they got economic assistance, and they got acceptance by the West. You know, it's somewhat misleading to think about them. This is a choice. The Soviet Union collapsed in 91, and Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan had multiple thousands of nuclear weapons, about 17,000 in Ukraine, 1,700 in Ukraine. But they didn't really have command of those. They didn't control them. They didn't know how to operate them, and they couldn't afford to keep them. So basically, it wasn't much of a choice to give them up. And if they had kept them, if they had declared themselves a nuclear power, they never would have had the relationship with the rest of Europe that they enjoyed for the past 30 years. So it was the logical thing to do, the right thing to do. They were supposed to get security, the word is assurances, that they were enshrined in text of the agreement, but neither Russia, the United States, or the other signatories have honored those security assurances in the current crisis.
In this country, there what is called the nuclear football, that I guess there's someone that carries the codes around and follows the president around. What do they have in Russia? How does that work?
Well, this is another obsolete system that needs to change. It was designed for a bolt out of the blue attack when you felt that the president had to be able to respond within minutes and launch the weapons within tens of minutes, which is what we have. In Russia, they have the similar system, except three people get the football. Putin gets it, the Minister of Defense gets it, the general who's in charge of the general staff gets it. It's a little unclear whether all three of them have to agree before they launch, or if they have our system where only one person can launch, only one person has the authority to do that, and they cannot be overruled. So the president doesn't need anybody's approval to do it, and once he gives the order, the missiles start flying. This is a system that has to change as well. No one person should have the power to destroy all humanity has built over the millennia and do it in an afternoon.
Here are a couple of comments from our listeners. Kevin says, I think this is a lot of posturing. No one is going to use nuclear weapons because both sides are terrified. I don't believe there really is a legitimate threat. What do you say, Joe Cerenzioni?
Well, I think that's a reasonable view. It's just that it's a view. It's a belief. You know, and think about it from the other side. Think if Putin is losing, and he's losing, he might not just lose the war, but he could lose his grip on power, and if with that he could lose his life. He might act like a gambler at the poker table who's losing a hand, who thinks one more bet will do it, that I bet the West will back down the way he thought Ukraine would back down. He could still have that belief, and he makes the gamble. He goes low yield, and he thinks he can control it. He thinks this is a measured step. That's the risk you're taking. Now, if you make that bet at the poker table and you lose a hand. You make that bet here, you could lose the planet.
Hmm. Here's an email from Bruce. What are the chances of a potential World War III if NATO and most of the world stand up to Russian aggression?
Well, this is the balancing act that Biden is doing. So I strongly support the president's restraint here. You do not want to commit U.S. or NATO forces in here. That's too big a risk. You could take a terrible war and turn it into a regional or a global war that could have dire consequences. You want to be very careful about the kinds of weapons that you commit to the Ukrainians at this point. You don't want to provoke Putin into taking even more dramatic escalatory actions that would then force you to take other actions. So yes, when President Biden says that direct NATO involvement would mean World War III, that is an accurate assessment, and we have to understand this. We can't wish these weapons away. We should have taken greater steps to get rid of them when we had the chance. I hope if we get through this, we won't make that same mistake again.
Joe, final question, and this really has to do with chemical weapons. What should we know about that?
I think it's actually likely that Putin will replay his Syrian playbook. You know, what we're seeing now in Mariupol, for example, is very similar to what we saw in Aleppo in Syria. Massive, indiscriminate civilian bombardment. And then, to further terrorize the population, he released, with his Syrian allies, chlorine gas. This is a basic chemical weapon. It was the first chemical weapon ever developed. It's heavier than air, meaning it will go down into the shelters. We didn't see that many people killed by this, several thousand in the Syrian war, but it terrified the population, and that's what Putin is going for. So if this stalemate continues, remarkably, the Ukrainians are blunting the Russian offensive. If it continues, expect Putin to escalate. He is not going to give in here. He's going to use more terror weapons, including, I'm afraid, chemical and possibly nuclear.
I mean, it seems like World War One, World War II, and World War III all sort of wrapped up together.
I think that's exactly right. And after those, you know, we have taken steps to eliminate chemical weapons from the arsenals of major countries, so you don't see the U.S. or Russia, for that matter, or any major country with large stockpiles of chemical weapons. But chlorine gas is something that we use for swimming pools. This is, you can make this easily in almost any country. So that's why you're seeing these sort of basic weapons rear their ugly head once again.
Well, Joe Cerenzioni, I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on, despite what we just talked about.
Indeed. And he is Distinguished Non-Resident Fellow at the Quincy Institute and a National Security Analyst. Well, as we all know, the ground and air war in Ukraine is devastating large swaths of the country, creating untold numbers of civilian casualties and a humanitarian crisis not seen in Europe in decades. Well, there's another war going on for hearts and minds involving news and information. Russia's tightly controlled media has made it a crime to call the war in Ukraine a war with stiff penalties. President Putin on Wednesday called pro-Western Russians scum and traitors and called for the self-purification of the country. This week, Ukrainian President Zelensky spoke to the U.S. Congress about military aid and played a video about the toll of the war on the Ukrainian people in graphic and horrifying detail. And yesterday, Arnold Schwarzenegger went on Twitter to speak directly to the Russian people about his affection for the country, telling them their government is lying about the war in Ukraine. Well, for the rest of the hour, the role of information and disinformation and the Russian war in Ukraine. And we're joined by Jane Litvinenko. She's senior research fellow in the Technology and Social Change Project, and that's at the Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. And Jane Litvinenko, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for covering this.
You're very welcome. And we're going from talking about, you know, the possibility, hopefully not, of some kind of use of a nuclear tactical weapon, and now talking about information, misinformation, even storytelling as a kind of tactic of war. How do you see the propaganda war or the information, disinformation, misinformation war in Ukraine?
Well, I think that one of the most effective things that we've seen over the last 23 days is Ukrainian advocacy and this Ukrainian citizen diplomacy that has really leveraged the social media networks and the connection that they provide to Western audiences to essentially make specific asks of governments. You know, what we're seeing is essentially Ukrainians talking to citizens of other countries directly and asking those citizens to lobby on their behalf to the politicians. And we see how effective that has been because we've seen the application of the strongest sanctions ever imposed on a single country. We've seen huge shipments to Ukraine of much needed weapons. And we've seen financial support that didn't just come from governments, but hundreds of millions of dollars raised for the Ukrainian army from people themselves. And so that, I think, has been the primary function of the online environment, and also the most important success that has had real material consequences.
Well, let me actually play a clip from Ukraine's President Zelensky. He addressed Congress on Wednesday, and this was a video from Kyiv making a plea for more help from the United States. He did show, as I mentioned in my introduction, a really, you know, graphic and heartbreaking of short but nonetheless powerful video. And then after the video, he didn't speak in Ukrainian. He spoke in English. And this is how he ended it.
Now I'm almost 45 years old. Today my age stopped when the heart of more than 100 children stopped beating. I see no sense in life if it cannot stop the death. And this is my main mission as the leader of my people, great Ukrainians. And as the leader of my nation, I am addressing the President Biden. You are the leader of the nation, of your great nation. I wish you to be the leader of the world. Being the leader of the world means to be the leader of peace. Thank you. Slava Ukraini.
He says being the leader of the world means to be the leader of the peace. If I can sort of contrast how you see Zelensky making a case for his country, this is, of course, for the U.S. government, and compare that to Vladimir Putin, who talked about his own people, as I mentioned, calling them scum and traitors. He talked about Nazis and denazifying Ukraine, such a different use of language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what that use of language is indicating is really how each country is governed. You know, Ukraine is a country that's governed by the people. In many ways, it's governed by revolution, which we had three of in the last 30 years. Ukrainian politicians understand generally that if they don't represent the people, then the people will stop supporting them. And when Zelensky speaks, he really speaks for voices of Ukrainians, not just for himself. And that's in very sharp contrast to Putin's speeches, because Putin's society, the Russian society, is built on a very top-down authoritarian view of how government, of the role that government plays in a country. He's not voicing the concerns of all of his people. He is not giving voice to those he governs. Instead, he's threatening those he governs. And I think that contrast is incredibly telling, because at its core, that contrast is what Ukrainians are fighting for right now. It's the ability to have a democracy, to govern ourselves. And Russian people are not, they don't have that ability right now.
We're up in a break here, and I'm just sort of stuck on Putin calling, you know, his own people scum. I mean, you don't hear that, you know, generally from a leader of a country.
Mm-hmm. And we've been hearing this from Putin for many years. He has done everything that he can to try to thwart the opposition in Russia. And so although his language has gotten sharper in the last 23 days, it is not fundamentally different from how he has governed Russia over the last 20 years.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Jane Litvinenko. Again, she's Senior Research Fellow in the Technology and Social Change Project, and that's at the Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. And we asked her to join us on Radio Times to talk about the role of information, disinformation, even misinformation and propaganda involving the Russian-led war on Ukraine. And again, you can join us. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And after this short break, we'll play a clip from a Russian journalist who went on TV to tell the country, stop the war. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me play a clip, and this is Russian state television journalist Marina Ovsyannikova, and she rushed onto the set of a live broadcast and held up a sign. This is in Russia. Held up a sign that said, no war, stop the war, don't believe propaganda. They lied to you here. Russians against the war. And then the camera cut away, and here she is explaining to CNN's Christiane Amanpour on Wednesday that many Russians are against the war.
I wanted to show to the world that Russians are against the war. The majority of Russians are against the war. And even if they support the Kremlin policy, they are pacifists. They hate war inside themselves. Everybody in Russia is scared by what's going on. Everybody is confused. Our life changed overnight. Russians are really scared by what's going on. And their faces show fear and confusion.
And that's clearly being translated. And Jane, she obviously did that at great risk to her own life. But it does raise questions about how firmly Putin can control what Russian people hear, whether it's on their controlled news media or whether it's on TikTok or, you know, all the other social media that people have so much access to.
Yeah, and I should say that Misa Vsyannikova is not the only person in Russia who's opposing the war. Thousands have shown up in the streets, and by most recent count, over 4,000 people have been arrested across Russia for protesting the war. But a poll that just came out today, actually, from independent sociologists, determined that about 71% of Russians support the war against Ukraine. And although the control over the information environment right now is getting tighter and tighter, it's important to remember that the war in Ukraine has been going on for 8 years, since 2014. And there has been independent media in Russia for 8 years that has been accessible to Russians. Now, the Kremlin's propaganda war has been going on for just as long. Since 2014, Russian president has been calling Ukrainians Nazis, has been calling Ukrainians bloodthirsty, has been sort of zombifying the population, if you will. And so this propaganda battle that we see, and this approach to locking down information, is fairly new, but it is important to remember that access to accurate information has existed over the last 8 years. And while many Russians oppose the war, many of them don't.
You know, I'm thinking of some of the video media that I've seen. Obviously, this is coming through, you know, CNN, for instance, and I've seen Ukrainian soldiers getting married to each other, you know, grandmothers making Molotov cocktails. One that really stays with me is a Ukrainian woman screaming at a Russian soldier and giving him sunflower seeds. That's, you know, I think that's one that a lot of people have seen. And these are such powerful narratives. How do you see them?
Yeah, well, those are all symbols of Ukrainian resistance. And it's important to remember that we've seen Ukrainian resistance reverberate around the world before, during the 2014 Revolution of Dignity, as well as the 2004 Orange Revolution. And so, of course, Ukrainians are people who are fiercely resistant to any kind of Russian occupation, not just in the recent past, but historically as well. And what we see really is there's no Ukrainian right now who's not involved in the war effort in some way. In Ukraine, people in occupied cities are going to the streets and continuing to protest their own occupation under the barrel of a gun. Abroad, people in the diaspora are filling church basements with boxes of medical supplies that they're sending to Ukraine. And everybody is sharing those stories, is sharing those powerful moments. You know, the one that you didn't mention, of course, is the Ukrainian farmers who are just towing around Russian military equipment, right?
Right, I forgot about that, yes. Yeah, but you're saying this is in terms of galvanizing public opinion, frankly, around the world, not everywhere, that these stories, these images are very powerful.
They are, and they're very human. You know, these are stories that are real, that we see videos of, that we can see with our own eyes, you know. And these are stories that speak directly to Western audiences to say, this is why you should support us. This is what our fight looks like. Here's how we're fighting, and here's how you can fight alongside us.
Well, let me play one more clip. And I frankly have to say that this really surprised me. It happened yesterday. Movie star, former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger put out a 9-minute video on Twitter telling the Russian people that they're being lied to about the war in Ukraine. But he also talked about his love for the people of Ukraine, how as a teenage young man, he fell in love with this Russian bodybuilder, talked about how strong he was, but also how kind he was. It was translated and also put on Twitter. We're hearing, obviously, the American or the English version. It's about 45 seconds. Let's give it a listen.
To the soldiers who are listening to this, remember that 11 million Russians have family connections to Ukraine. So every bullet you shoot a brother or a sister. every bomb or every shell that falls is falling not on an enemy, but on a school or a hospital or a home. I know that the Russian people are not aware of such things are happening. So I urge the Russian people and the Russian soldiers in Ukraine to understand the propaganda and the disinformation that you're being told. I ask you to help me spread the truth. Let your fellow Russians know the human catastrophe that is happening in Ukraine.
And again, that's Arnold Schwarzenegger. Let me correct myself. He talked about his love for the people of Russia in this video. But let me hear from you, Jane. What did you make of that?
Well, you know, I think it was certainly a powerful effort that is adding to a larger conversation about getting the truth to Russian people. We've seen President Zelensky speak Russian and direct his words to the Russian people. We've seen even, you know, influencers on social media who are from Ukraine speak directly to their Russian audiences. There have been massive campaigns to text and phone Russians to explain to them what's going on. And really the reason for that is because Ukrainians need for the Russian people to rise up against this war en masse, like the rest of the world has risen up against this war en masse. That's exactly what Mr. Schwarzenegger has been talking about in his own address as well. And I encourage your listeners to seek out the full version because it's quite powerful. And the reason for that is because Putin's oppression affects his own people as well. Now, of course, he's not bombing hospitals in Russia the same way that he's bombing hospitals in Ukraine. But he has devastated two countries, not one. And it's within the power of Russian people to open a second front, a domestic front, and to stand up to Putin's regime and to say, we've had enough. And you can't keep doing this to Ukrainians, and you can't keep decimating our own country as well.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jane Litvinenko, and again, Senior Research Fellow in the Technology and Social Change Project at the Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. And we're talking about the use of information, disinformation, propaganda, videos, Twitter, social media in this sort of war of words involving the country of Ukraine. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Jean tweets saying, I have to disagree that leaders don't say things like people are scum. Trump used similar language for 6 years. As far as I can tell, he still is. Leaders who aren't dictators don't use language like that. Authoritarians do. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Putin is one of many authoritarians around the world who are dealing a lot of damage to their own people. Trump is, of course, another example, but we've seen similar language coming out of Brazil, coming out of the Philippines, and coming out of many regions where people are fighting their own fight against authoritarianism and against the horrors that authoritarianism brings. And so that's a very important point, because of course Putin is incredibly powerful. And of course we need to keep talking about the war in Ukraine because he's bombing children. But that doesn't mean that this is not a global trend.
We talk about, you know, debunking information. There's also something called pre-bunking. What is that?
Yeah, it's essentially preparing audiences for false information that they may see. And if I could give you an example,
sure.
A couple of days ago, a Ukrainian television channel called Ukraine 24, which broadcasts 24 hours a day to get accurate information out, was hacked, presumably by Russian hackers. And on their website was a very bad fake video of President Zelensky essentially calling on people to put down arms. Now, aside from the fact that this video kind of looked like a bobblehead, the part of the reason why it was so ineffective is because for the last 2 weeks, that same television channel and many other media outlets and government outlets as well have been warning Ukrainians to say, here's what a deep fake is. If you see Zelensky say something that is out of character that he would not otherwise say, don't believe it. And so it's that preparation in understanding that the conversation will shift. And with those shifts in conversation, we may see false information, we may see decontextualized information. Essentially preparing audiences for this, it's incredibly important because when we know what to expect, we know how to protect ourselves from it.
And is the goal of disinformation not just to give wrong information, but also to confuse people, even exhaust people, make them not trust whatever media sources they use?
That's precisely it. Exhaustion is the point. Muddying the waters is the point. You know, pro-Russian trolls don't expect for the West to come out en masse waving Russian flags saying we support Putin. What they expect is for Western audiences to be tired of the war and to want to turn their attention elsewhere. And once that attention is turned elsewhere, then more atrocities can happen and less support can happen. We talked earlier about how a lot of the support from the West is driven by the public demand for that support. And so if disinformation succeeds in lowering the public demand, then the support may dry up too. And so that is sort of the tricky part about disinformation. You know, nobody expects for people waving Ukrainian flags today to be waving Russian flags tomorrow. Instead, the point is to try to get the audiences to look away.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, a couple of more minutes. And you know, this is the tricky part, too, about the coverage. You know, we're not CNN, clearly. We're here in Philadelphia. We've done maybe 3 or 4 or 5, 6 shows in the last month or so about this crisis, this war now in Ukraine. And you know, whether we keep that up, whether CNN stays, you know, in Russia, whether the dissidents, the people fighting the kind of fight that you are, will stay with this story is and whether the world will get exhausted hearing about Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big question, and I can tell you that I, as a woman with family in Ukraine, and many of my friends and colleagues with family in Ukraine, are kept awake at night by that question of what happens if the world's attention turns away. And the only thing that we can do is to keep telling our stories and to keep showing what's happening to us, and to keep up the advocacy. Even if news networks turn away, we will continue using social media networks to get our message out. And so it's my hope that the world doesn't turn away from Ukraine.
And final question, when Tucker Carlson says, why do I hate Putin? Has Putin ever called me a racist? Has he ever threatened to get me fired for disagreeing with him? How does that play in Russia?
Well, Russian state television absolutely loves Tucker Carlson. They play clips of Tucker Carlson on the main most watched news programs. They have increased the frequency with which they air Tucker Carlson within Russia. And I think that tells you everything you need to know about Mr. Carlson's point of view.
Well, Jane Litvinenko, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times. I was going to ask you about your family, but I hope you can stay in touch, and I hope that they can stay safe in Ukraine.
Thank you, and thank you for covering this.
Absolutely. She's Senior Research Fellow in the Technology and Social Change Project at the Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. And we began with Joe Cirincione, Distinguished Non-Resident Fellow at the Quincy Institute and a National Security Analyst. To replay this hour and many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org. Look for Radio Times under Programs, and you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.